If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
At IKEA, your dream home is a blue bag away. No matter the size of your space or budget, we've got everything you need to turn your dreams into reality. And now with new lower prices on hundreds of our most popular products, bringing the dream home is even easier. Like the gray Strandom wing chair, was $369, now $299. And the IKEA Plus 365 9-piece cookware set was $129.99, now $89.99. And hundreds more. Shop new lower prices at ikea-usa.com today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. I'm sure that many of you will have watched yesterday's Cricket World Cup final, and on today's podcast we've got the extraordinary story of the first Indian cricket team to tour Great Britain. Our production editor Spencer Mizzen headed to Leicester to speak to the historian Prashant Kidambi, whose new book, Cricket Country, tells the story of the 1911 All India Tour.
To kick off, Prashant, in the preface to your book, you cite the quote, "Cricket is an Indian game accidentally invented by the English." I mean, is that a view you subscribe to personally?
Well, it's a view that has some difficulties with it, in that it seeks to overturn one myth with another. I mean, the idea that you know cricket is a purely English game, that was very much central to the myths that English cricket told about itself. But of course, right from its beginning, cricket becomes a very global game, and there were many different sort of elements that went into the making of English cricket. This view that cricket is an Indian game accidentally discovered by the English is actually something that has become very congenial to Indians, because now they've come to appropriate cricket as an Indian game.
Sure.
And it has come with its own myths somehow, that, you know, cricket is somehow a game that reflects Indian society, that, you know, its hierarchical nature or the slow nature of cricket all chimes with what Indian society is. And I think there are a whole set of myths that have crept up or have come to be associated with this view, which the book actually challenges. So I would say I'm very ambivalent about the formulation.
Just rewinding, how was the game of cricket first introduced to India?
It came with the English. The first recorded game is supposed to have been in the Gulf of Cambat, or Gulf of Cambay, as it was known, in 1721. It really takes off in the early 19th century and is played largely in the colonial enclaves, the British settlements, mostly the port towns, Calcutta, Madras, but Bombay above all. And it's really in Bombay that it establishes itself as a very important part of British social life. And of course, it's in Bombay too that Indians begin to take it up in a big way. So cricket really comes with the British, and it's played initially by men of arms, as it were, sailors and soldiers. Then increasingly, as the British presence increases after 1857, it comes to be played by more diverse groups who've come to India, as part of the imperial encounter.
So but at the moment, you're talking mainly about British people playing the sport rather than Indians.
Well, so at the outset, till about the 1830s and 1840s, it's largely played by the British. Right. It only begins to be taken up by Indians sometime around the late 1830s, 1840s, and more, sort of after the 1850s, that it really kind of takes off and Indians begin to play it. And it's largely played by Indians living in the cities that were established by the British. So Calcutta, Bombay, Madras. But Bombay is the one that really takes the lead.
Was it adopted by sort of all communities and all religions originally, or was it restricted more to the sort of the ruling classes?
It's a very interesting story. The first Indians to take it up were the Parsis. The Parsis, of course, a very small community who had settled in Western India. They'd migrated from what was then known as Persia, which, modern-day Iran. And they'd come and settled in Western India, originally along the coastal, in the coastal areas, but then moved to Bombay, the coastal areas of Gujarat, I should say. And then they moved to Bombay and became resident. They became the residents of Bombay. They were largely concentrated in Bombay. And they are very closely associated with the British in terms of trade. And then there are Parsi businessmen who make huge fortunes, the China trade, as it were, working with British partners. And of course, that then also fuels their own self-representations as a very anglicized British community. And it's as part of that, as I show, that they take up cricket too. And sure. And cricket becomes one of the ways in which they signify and communicate their Britishness, as it were.
Right. And when did it start sort of spreading into other communities?
The first Hindu cricket club is supposed to have been formed in 1866. Again, all of this is really happening in Bombay.
Yeah.
We have much less information for what's going on elsewhere. Bombay has been seen, and in large measure, this is true. This is where most of the Indian communities who took up the game were originally concentrated. So the Parsis, as I said, took it up in the air from the late 1830s onwards. The first Hindu club is supposed to have come up in 1866. It's really from about the 1870s that you start cricket spreading amongst other communities. And it's by the end of the 19th century, it's being played by the Hindus, it's being played by the Muslims, and of course, other communities too.
What did the British make of Indians playing cricket? I mean, were they receptive to that idea?
So in the book, I show how the British attitude to Indians taking up cricket is very ambivalent.
Right.
Initially, when they see the Parsis take up cricket, they're both amused, but also slightly dismissive. And as the Parsis begin to get better at the game, that turns increasingly into a certain kind of hostility. So ambivalence turns into hostility. And I document how in the late 19th century, there were many disparaging racist remarks directed at the Parsis, who, incidentally, in other areas of life are regarded as close collaborators of the British. But in the cricket field, what you see are growing tensions as the Parsis start getting better at the game. The English start increasingly looking at this with hostility because it seems to call into question their own narratives about how Europeans are superior to Indians physically and losing on the sporting field calls into question those ideas of European racial dominance.
Okay. Why do you think Indians embrace cricket so enthusiastically, in these early days?
The argument in my book is that we need to think about this question differently from how it's been thought before. And there are two kinds of ways of thinking about it. One is that we should see cricket as a success of the British civilizing mission. This was a story told by the imperial elites, as it were, that cricket was the way by which they civilized Indian society. It becomes a tool in the civilizing mission. As opposed to that, there's another viewpoint which has become more fashionable in recent years, which is cricket is a site of resistance. Cricket is where Indians express their resistance to the Raj. My view is that actually we should think about this question differently. We should think about cricket as a sort of cultural resource, which is used by different sections of Indian society for different ends. The Parsis use it to demonstrate their Britishness, to demonstrate their taking up of British norms, values, and practices. The Indian princes, the princely states, when they start playing cricket towards the end of the 19th century, use it as a way of acquiring prestige and recognition in the eyes of the British establishment. Playing cricket is seen as a way of being, as an entry point into the British imperial establishment. The Dalit cricketers I talk about, for them, cricket becomes a site of justice, the quest for social justice and a rebuttal, as it were, of the discrimination that they have to confront.
Could you just expand on who the Dalits were?
So the Dalits were basically what were known as the... they were the most sort of discriminated against community within Hindu society. So the Dalits, it is really an existence marked by degradation, humiliation, and of course, economic exploitation.
Sure.
So to have cricketers in this team that I talk about, you know, who are coming from the Dalit communities, is quite remarkable. Now, for the Dalits, for the two Dalit players in this team, cricket is a way by which they not only showcase their own extraordinary abilities, but also a means by which they seek to achieve social recognition and question the inequities of the caste system. So basically, my argument, and for the Muslims, when they take up cricket, it becomes also a way by which they can rethink their relationship both with the British imperial establishment, but also fashion a new kind of identity in the colonial context, where you can try and reconcile Western learning with Islamic teaching. You know, so my argument is that rather than thinking of cricket as a sort of binary, you know, it's either the civilizing mission or an act of resistance, you see cricket actually as a cultural resource which enters Indian society and acquires different kinds of meanings. Different groups see in the game different opportunities and different possibilities.
Okay, so your book, Cricket Country, tells the story of the first cricket team to represent India in Britain, which happened in 1911. But am I right in saying that this wouldn't have been the first time that the people of Britain would have been exposed to Indian cricketers? Because wasn't there some superstar Indian cricketers who played in Britain before that?
Yes, you're absolutely right. The first and the greatest of them really is Prince Ranjit Singhji, or Ranji as he was known. Ranji comes over to England in the late 1880s. By 1891, he's playing for Cambridge. And in the years, in the mid-1890s, he quickly becomes the most celebrated English cricketer, the most celebrated English cricketer after W.G. Grace.
Sure, yeah.
So you had W.G. Grace, and then there was this Indian prince.
Wow, right.
And Ranji was regarded as, you know, through this lens of Oriental Orientalism. He was seen he was exotic, yeah. He was this magician who, you know, somebody said he never played a Christian stroke in his life, you know, that sort of thing.
Okay.
He was seen as something magical, but also something, you know, these are the benefits of having a vast empire, that you would have these sorts of exotic characters turn up. And Ranji was seen as exotic, he was seen as somebody who had, you know, who played more like a magician than he did like a normal cricketer.
And am I right in saying he represented England?
He represented England, and that becomes the focus of a great deal of angst within the English cricketing establishment. There were some, like Lord Harris, who had once been the governor of Bombay, a key figure in the MCC, the Marylebone Cricket Club at Lord's, who believed that Ranji was a bird of passage, that he was an Indian, he could not play for England. He himself, Harris himself, had been born in Trinidad in the West Indies. You know, that never sort of came in the way of himself, you know, of his regarding himself as an English cricketer. But he had great misgivings about Ranji playing for England. But selection in those days was not centralised. So the Lancashire Cricket County Cricket Club, the match at Old Trafford in 1896 against Australians, they included Ranji in the team. He scores a big century, becomes a hero, and over the next 3 years has this astonishing success on the cricket field. He's an icon, you know, and known across the empire.
How did he change English or Britain's perceptions of India?
So the key way in which he changes it, from my perspective, is that he calls into question the settled idea that cricket is essentially an Anglo-Saxon game. So you had this Indian prince who creates these extraordinary strokes, who's hugely successful on the cricket field, scores tons of runs, How do you explain it? So the way they explained it was by saying, well, he's not normal. He's a magician. He's magical. He's an Oriental. These Oriental, you know, for all you know, Ranji could have, in this view, for all you knew, Ranji could equally have been a snake charmer or you know, could perform rope tricks or whatever.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
At its heart, there is somehow the idea that the cricket team embodies the idea of India, you know, that it reflects the diversity of India. You have players coming from different regions, different religions, different backgrounds, coming together as a team. Cricket is seen as a unifying force, a unifying symbol.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Okay, so if we get on to the tour of 1911, the one that your book is essentially based on, how did the tour come about? I mean, who were the prime movers and what were their motivations?
There's growing political violence in India targeting British officials, because by this time, a growing number of Indian youths had started getting very disillusioned with the moderate politics of the Congress. They felt that the only way the British could be made to listen, to take note of Indian nationalist aspirations would be through violence, through the bomb, as it were. So between 1907 and 1909, you had growing instances of what they called revolutionary violence. You know,
this is a surge in nationalism.
A surge in a radical topic. Kind of sure. Nationalism, eschewing the, you know, the politics of the Congress, which was seen as moderate, too mendicant, too base, you know, too focused on simply petitioning and praying the British to cast an eye over their grievances. Now the idea was the British can only be chucked out of India by using force, and so the bomb and the gun become the favored tools of resistance. So between 1907 and 1909, the political climate in India grows quite dark, because of course these attempts to assassinate British officials and throw bombs at them and so on is met with growing repression. So it's in this context that you have a bid to send an Indian cricket team again, but this and to establish and show to the British that India would be a loyal part of the British Empire. So it's being championed by the moderate elements, those who see themselves as British Indians, who want to emphasize the loyalty of India to the British Empire. Because the reason they're worried is that the most spectacular instance of violence happens not in India, it happens in London. You have the secretary, one of the sort of people who's working at the India office, which is headed by the Secretary of State for India, a man named William Curzon Wiley is assassinated. And he had, of course, been an old India hand. He's assassinated by a young Indian Punjabi named Madan Lal Dhingra, who, of course, is then executed at London's Pentonville prison for having carried out this.
So tensions are high.
Yeah, so this is in July 1909.
Yeah.
And in the British conservative press, there's a growing demand that we have to start thinking about having Indians come freely into the country. Madan Lal Dhingra was a student at the UCL, University College London.
Yeah.
And the idea is that, look, it's clear that the civilizing mission is not working. can we really afford to have these dangerous Indian students coming to India, to England, and then becoming terrorists, becoming assassins? So maybe the time has come to prevent the unrestricted entry of Indians who are using their status as British subjects to come to the metropolis, to perhaps put a stop to that.
So the tour is an expression of loyalty.
Yes.
To the imperial project.
Yes.
Right, okay.
So the tour is, as far as the promoters are concerned, yeah. Because what the book also shows is once you start a project like this, the meanings that attach themselves to it cannot simply be subsumed under loyalism, because there are, of course, many Indians who will see this as an opportunity also to show the British that they can play the game, that it is about as much about recognition as it is about loyalism. So it's about the quest for many Indians to show that they had the physical capabilities to be the equal of Europeans. This is not so much resistance as some historians see it. It's actually recognition. But for those who are minded, who see themselves as British Indians, the idea being that you can be a patriotic Indian but be part of the British Empire. For those who had that sort of idea of India being part of the empire, these acts of violence were beginning to call into question the imperial connection. They were very worried that, you know, Britain would increasingly become ill-disposed towards India. So the aim of the tour is actually as an act of bringing together Britain and India through cricket.
And so you've got there's a few colourful characters, aren't there, come on this tour with their own personal motivations for doing so. I mean, wonder if you could sort of talk me through one or two of those.
Well, the answer to this question, you're absolutely right. And actually, the reason I started this project was because of these characters. Because I didn't know this backstory, you see. I only saw the characters first. And I was drawn to these characters because the captain is a 19-year-old portly prince, a Sikh prince. The star player is a Dalit who, as I explained, comes from one most communities that are most discriminated against by upper caste Hindus. The team itself had Parsis, Muslims, and Hindus, and the team was chosen on sectarian lines. So I was very drawn to this idea of how did this motley collection of men come together? It was only during the course of the research that all these, the wider history, the larger, longer story, which is what the first part of the book really does. It looks at the history of how this happened, and then you start discovering through the research. I discovered all these failed attempts, the political context, etc. But coming back to these characters, it is really extraordinary. So Bhupinder Singh, Maharaja Bhupinder Singh, the ruler of Patiala, has just been made ruler a year before the tour. And that decision itself was taken after a great deal of hand-wringing and a great deal of discussion and debate within the imperial establishment. Like his father, who had died very young, but was widely acknowledged or widely criticized for being debauched in that he spent all his time drinking and with women and so on. Though he was also recognized as a very good sportsman and he did much for sport, especially cricket in the late 1890s. So it was widely assumed that Bhupinder Singh was going the way of his father because at the time that he was, you know, he becomes ruler as soon as he turns 18. Before that, of course, there's a council of regency that runs the state and so on. There are all sorts of rumors about his sexual escapades, the fact that he's surrounding himself with the wrong company and so on. He's made the ruler of Patiala. He's given his formal ruling powers after a great deal of debate, as I said. And Bhupinder sees the tour as a way of rehabilitating himself in the eyes of the imperial establishment, but also using it as a resource to develop direct links with the imperial establishment in London, because he's been given a very hard time by the local British officials in Patiala in the Punjab. So for him, it becomes a way of actually, if you develop a link with those who are in the higher up the food chain, as it were, then that becomes a resource with which you can handle your local tormentors. So Bhupinder comes to Britain very much to use the tour as a way of connecting. And it's, of course, the year of the coronation. He knows, you know, and there are going to be all these princes. They're going to be, you know, it's going to be a huge global event. He wants to use it to develop links with the British imperial establishment, directly with the King Emperor, in fact, the new King Emperor, George V. And he sees this tour as a means of, as a political tour, really, rather than a cricketing tour. As it happens, he only plays 3 cricket matches. He disappears. He spends all his time hobnobbing with the imperial establishment. He plays polo. He goes to the polo clubs because these are the places where the imperial elite gather.
Yeah.
He spends all his time cultivating his ties with the imperial establishment. Cricket is a subsidiary thing as far as after the third match, he's off. Because the team loses its first 11 matches.
I was going to ask you, how did they fare on the
pitch? Yeah, so the last part of the book really is talking about how the Indian team fares on the pitch. And they do very badly to start with.
How long is the tour, sorry?
So they come over, they reach Britain on the 21st of May.
Right.
And they're here right until the last day of August. They leave on the 1st of September.
So it's a substantial time.
And it's not like tours these days. These people travel to every part of the country. They're not given test match status, of course. So they play county teams. So what I show in the book is how they're incorporated into one of the most extraordinary summers in the history of English county cricket, because they go down playing, they're really like a brown county team, a peripatetic county team, if you will. And essentially what happens is they lose. They're pitted against all the first-class strong county teams first. And the idea behind this, as far as the British imperial promoters were concerned, was that this is an exercise in teaching them how to play. So they have to be tested. So they put them, it's a relentless schedule where they're playing matches, two matches a week. So you play a match 3 days, then you take the journey, and the journeys were not logically arranged. So you'd be going up and down across the country. So they go to Wales, they go to Scotland, they go to Ireland, they play in England, of course. And they do very badly against the established county teams. They lose the first 11 matches. It's only slowly the 12th match that they play against Leicestershire where the tide turns. Leicestershire is a bit like the Indian cricket team that year. They've lost all their matches in the county season. So you have two teams which meet here in July. In fact, exactly, almost 180 days to the day, as it were. And the Indians beat Leicestershire. And that's when they start, their tour sort of turns around to an extent. They start beating some of the other county teams, some of the weaker county teams. And then, of course, once they start playing the second-class teams, because these are all first-class teams, once they start playing the second-class teams, they start doing much better. And, of course, on the whole, they lose more matches than they win. But they don't. By the end of the tour, they've shown enough flair, enough skill for them to be treated with more respect than they were when the tour started. They were greeted, of course, with great cordiality by the imperial establishment, for whom they were a symbol of our civilizing mission has succeeded. So, they were also the old India hands, the people who had left India, who'd served in India, come back, who came out. So Lord Harris, who plays for Kent, comes out and leads the Kent team against them. Lord Hawke leads the Yorkshire team against them, though Hawke hadn't been in India. And you also have Anglo-Indians, as they were called, that is the British who had lived in India, who had come back to Britain to settle down, who took great interest in the doings of the team. So as far as the attendances are concerned, the numbers were not sort of humongous, but the social reception was very cordial. They were greeted with a great degree of warmth wherever they went.
Can you just briefly tell me a little bit about the political landscape in Britain in 1911 and Britain's attitude to India and its empire at this point?
So this is one of the most fascinating things when I was researching the book, because I had expected, I had read so much about the golden age of cricket and, the Edwardian age, the apogee of the British Empire. It's really sort of seen from through a lens of nostalgia, isn't it? Especially the chasm of the First World War, that you see it as this golden period before the First World War, when things were so settled, sort of Britain was the top nation in the world, everything was in its place. Now, to an extent, that was true. It was an extraordinarily glorious summer, one of the hottest summers. In fact, there were points when the summer became positively uncomfortable because it was one of the hottest summers since the 17th century.
Right.
But there were also glorious days in which the sun came out and British high society was in its element. The season was in its full splendor. And yet, at the same time, you could already see the intimations of trouble and intimations of political unrest. This is, of course, the period that, George Dangerfield very famously said was, the strange death of liberal England. This was, of course, it comes bang in the middle of that. And it was a period when you had this extraordinary crisis in the House of Lords, you know, with the Liberal government threatening to create 500 new peers to get their legislation through, and this being sort of resisted by the conservative aristocratic sort of politicians in the House of Lords. It was also a summer of extraordinary labor unrest. Unrest in the docks, unrest in other sectors of British industry, transport strikes. At one point, there are sort of clashes between troops and you know workers on the streets. Liverpool, you know, sees some of the worst clashes. In fact, there's a very sort of vivid image in my book of how, you know, at one point the local councillors in Liverpool are begging Churchill to sort of send the troops in, and you have a ship that is lined up outside the Merseyside with its guns trained on Liverpool. You know,
right.
So there's almost a sense that some kind of social revolution is happening. So it was a time of extraordinary unrest. Of course, you also had towards the end of the summer the firing in South Wales at Llanelli, which, you know, so which creates huge unrest as well. So the Indians are traveling across the British Isles when the country is going up in flames.
Sure.
So in two respects, it was the most extraordinary of summers, because when I started off, I had this image of these cowering Indians going to Britain. It's going to be cold, you know, unfamiliar setting, and it's going to be, you know, the sort of a very stable society with imperial grandeur. Now, there is, of course, some of that, because this was the summer of the coronation and you had a lot of imperial splendor. But you also have this other image of a country which is, you know, suffering from a heat wave, and the Indians actually really struggle with the heat. In one match, right, the Indians, two of the Indian players have to be rested because they are not able to cope with the heat. It's also a summer of extraordinary political unrest, you know, of the kind that the Indians would have much more likely expected back home, you know. So a society seemingly up in arms, as it were, and the Indians making their way across the British Isles. So I think it makes for a sort of strange, you know, the setting is quite extraordinary for the tour.
Okay, you write in your book that this is a tale of how the idea of India took shape on the pitch long before the country gained its independence. Could you just expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, I think... one way of thinking about this question is to think of the contemporary discourse around Indian cricket, and especially the Indian cricket team, Team India, as it's popularly known. And in recent years, you've seen a very shrill hyper-nationalism around cricket. Even this World Cup, we've had our share of controversies. The Indian wicketkeeper, MS Dhoni, was created a furore when he stepped out onto the field in one of the matches wearing wicket-keeping gloves, which had the insignia of, you know, a military insignia, as it were.
Right.
You had the tensions between India and Pakistan before the World Cup, which even meant that some Indians before the World Cup started were calling for a boycott of the match against Pakistan. You've had other kinds of ways in which cricket, I mean, the fact that the Indians stepped out onto the match against England wearing orange jerseys, that was seen as a sort of growing saffronization of the game, so of the cricket team. So at its heart, there is somehow the idea that the cricket team embodies the idea of India, you know, that it reflects the diversity of India. You have players coming from different regions, different religions, different backgrounds, coming together as a team. That it is in a society that is divided along many different lines, caste, religion, class, etc., cricket is seen as a unifying force, a unifying symbol, almost a natural expression of the idea of India.
Sure.
And what this book shows is that, first of all, that idea was neither natural nor inevitable, because the first Indian cricket team was formed 36 years before India became independent. And that team itself didn't emerge organically or automatically. It took 12 years, three failed attempts before this idea takes shape on the cricket pitch. So it was to show how contingent and historically rooted the notion of India on the cricket pitch is. And of course, that cricket and the nation can be linked, or the relationship can be expressed in different ways. Today, you see the cricket team as almost soldiers on the cricket field, you know. I mean, many of the Indian cricketers themselves have come to talk in that language, you know, soldiers on the cricket field, you know, war minus the shooting, that sort of language. That cricket is seen as a way in which you achieve sort of political goals in ways that cannot be achieved through war or whatever. And cricket is seen as the expression, cricket has come to express a shrill hyper-nationalism. But here was a period and a time when you had an Indian cricket team that sought to express, obviously, the idea of India, but an idea of India very different from what we have today, and an idea of India which is actually seeking to reinforce ties with the empire, which emphasizes the place of India within the British imperial system.
Do you think it succeeded in doing that? I mean, what was the main legacy, would you say, of the tour?
It did succeed for a moment. It did succeed in the short term, because clearly the fact that an Indian cricket team toured Britain, went around at a time of growing social chasm, at a time of growing political discord between Britons and Indians, clearly sent out a positive message. It reinforced the fact that there were elements, as far as, I'm talking from the viewpoint of the British imperial establishment, it seemed to reassure them that, you know, that they should not entirely give up on the civilizing mission. One of the things that you see in the discourse about the tour, in the popular press, in the writings of British officials at this point in time, report, you know, vis-a-vis the tour, is that they said, see, this shows that the civilizing mission does, after all, succeed. Cricket can be a way in which we can, we can reinforce our connections with India. And that the fact that Indians are taking up to the game and forging an Indian team that comes out to play against us in this manner, that is an affirmation of the imperial project. But of course, the First World War is a key game changer. What happens is that after the First World War, the nature of the relationship, political relationship between India and Britain is completely turned upside down. Where earlier Congress nationalists could conceive of being patriots while at the same time affirming loyalty to the empire, now under Gandhi, who increasingly comes to lead a mass anti-colonial movement, and who has himself become very disillusioned with the idea, this older idea that India could be part of the British Empire. Because remember, Gandhi at one time had even, undertaken operations on, during the Boer War when he was in South Africa, sure, and elsewhere. He had seen himself as a patriot, but at the same time, had been able to visualize a place for India within the empire. Now, of course, that is jettisoned. The old moderate nationalists are pushed aside. There's a more strident, radical nationalism, a mass nationalism, which now increasingly can begin to see an India that is outside of the British Empire.
That was Prashant Kadambi. Prashant's book, Cricket Country, An Indian Odyssey in the Age of Empire, is out on the 25th of July, published by Oxford University Press. For more on global history, check out our bi-monthly sister publication, BBC World Histories magazine.